I'm Kim Masters, host of KCRW's The Business, and this is the latest installment of our monthly TV podcast, The Spinoff. Now here's host Michael Schneider of TV Guide magazine.
Thanks, Kim. This is The Spinoff, and joining me here in the studio is AJ Marischal of Variety. Hey, AJ.
Hi.
Good to see you again.
Hello.
And, of course, from the studios of KUNV in Las Vegas, Nevada, hitting the slots, we've got Joe Adalian of Vulture.com. Hey, Joe.
Buenos dias.
Buenos dias. So, first, we must take a moment here to say how grateful we are to everyone, every listener who made suggestions on what to call this damn thing. In the end, we went with The Spinoff, and starting this week, you'll be able to subscribe to The Spinoff through iTunes, or wherever you download podcasts. It will also still be found in the podcast queue of KCRW's The Business as well.
Makes it for a great holiday gift.
Yes, and free. So on the list today, we're going to be discussing big event programming. The Sound of Music Live, Bonnie and Clyde, and a lot more. If it's December, it must be event programming time. We're also going to be talking about violence on TV. So we've all seen those letters used to identify or rate TV shows' content up on the corner of your screen. Do the audience heed them? Is there a difference in how broadcast TV networks assess violent content and cable shows? We'll discuss that later in the show. And finally, we're going to tackle the year in television. It's our last podcast of 2013, so we'll look back at the TV stories and trends that were the most interesting to us this year. So let's kick things off this time by talking about big events. Now, of course, The Sound of Music Live was a big event on NBC. Craig Zaden and Neil Maron, who, of course, are known for the movie Chicago and all sorts of different productions, were behind it. Carrie Underwood played the role that Julie Andrews, of course, made famous in the movie. This time around, it was broadcast live on NBC, and apparently audiences were starved for that kind of production. 18.5 million people showed up. Not to say they all loved it if you were on Twitter at the time. It became fashionable to make fun of it and bash it a little bit, but we do live in an era where people do hate watch television on social media. Nonetheless, it was a huge, huge, big event and of course, opened up the conversation once again to, well, why aren't the broadcast networks doing more of these? And it looks like they're going to. So, Joe, why don't we talk about this first? You actually wrote about the impact that maybe these big numbers are going to have on what the networks do next.
Well, I think even before Sound of Music Live, hashtag SOML, was a big hit, the networks have sort of realized that they need to get into this business. And, you know, what is event television? You know, it could be as simple as something old-fashioned as a miniseries, which is nothing new or exciting. It's something that was a hallmark of network television through much of the 70s and 80s. What really got the current trend going was when Hatfields and McCoy went on A&E and our history and did huge numbers. At that time, record numbers for cable. And then The Bible came on. And so I think what you're going to see in the next couple of years going forward is networks looking for any way to break out of the rut and get people to pay attention to them, and even more importantly, watch in the moment live.
Well, so I'm going to be the cynic here, and you know, obviously, a couple years ago, the networks all decided to get out of this business. They got out of the long form business,
right?
First of all, the miniseries and original movies. The networks pretty much stopped doing that, ceded that business to cable. But even some of the cable networks stopped doing that too, and suddenly you have a handful of successes, Hatfields and McCoys and The Bible being two of the big ones on the scripted side. And now suddenly everyone's back in the business. All the networks relaunched their long-form divisions. They brought in new executives. It's just such a TV move, such a stereotypical TV move. Get out of this business until somebody has a hit, and then suddenly, wait a second, looks like viewers love long-form. So let's bring it back.
It's totally reactive to the struggle with DVR these days. It's how are we going to get people to tune in live? Well, if we bill it as this big event program with a lot of urgency around it, people may not wait 3, 5, 7 days to tune into it from their DVR, you know? So it's all around the challenge of how do we get people to watch this now?
But, you know, Mike, I think you're a little bit too cynical in sort of slamming the network for this reactive move, going back, oh my God. The thing is, I think TV has changed dramatically since they got out of the business of long-form and event programming. Even in the 5 or 6 years, 7 years since they got out of that business, their numbers have all fallen dramatically by 30, 40%. DVRs have become huge, and Most importantly of all, Twitter's come into the equation. And one of the key reasons that the networks got out of this space to begin with was because it was too hard to market. It was too hard to get people's attentions and cut through the clutter of so much programming with some one-off production. Well, now, guess what? Twitter and BuzzFeed and the internet in general serves as a giant viral marketing machine. They don't need to spend even as much money as they once did to get people to realize, hey, there is something on. And I think that the combination of Twitter and an internet culture that supports something different and something new every single day is making it easier for the networks to get attention to these projects.
Which is why I think Sound of Music Live was sort of just the perfect recipe for big numbers. It's an established property. You know, you don't need to see the Sound of Music to know some of the classic Hills Are Alive songs and be able to sing that jingle. You have a notable name attached to it with Carrie Underwood, who has a very strong social media presence, and she became a celebrity on television on American Idol. You have a time when people are more open to specials with the holiday season, whether that be, you know, the yearly broadcast of It's a Wonderful Life or Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. And you have a property that, and I think that this is so important, I wasn't watching Sound of Music Live because I liked it. I was hate watching it. You have something that people are willing to hate watch and then tweet about, which, whether networks want to admit it or not, is totally a factor in a show being successful.
Which actually makes me wonder what the second run of Sound of Music Live is going to do if everyone sort of hate watched it the first time around and then heard that it's a slog at 3 hours and might not tune into a second run. They would be smart to re-edit it and cut it down.
And the ratings spiked at 9 p.m., so halfway through, possibly because people caught on via social media.
Well, let's talk about the other long form that I mentioned earlier, Bonnie and Clyde, a miniseries that across three networks that are co-owned, A&E, Lifetime, and History, they basically roadblocked it, which means it all aired at the same time in order to cum a number and to get it into the largest audience possible. So it did a respectable 9.8 million viewers. But at the same time, considering it was three networks, it didn't come close to what Hatfields and McCoys did or The Bible. Joe, was it a hit?
Is it a hit? No, it's no Bible and it's no Hatfields and McCoy. I also don't think it was nearly as expensive as those. You didn't have Kevin Costner in this. You didn't have God in this. So I think 10 million viewers across three networks, yeah, that's a good number, especially if the company that owns them all, any network, sold it as one price. 10 million viewers for cable? That's a hit. And they took lemons and made it into lemonade. Maybe if this had aired just on one network, it would have only done 4 million. But once again, what a great marketing hook. It's going to be everywhere. Now, everyone who has Lifetime, has History, has A&E. These are not tiny little networks. There was no real reason for anyone to do that except that they all have distinct brand identities, right? The average Lifetime viewer isn't necessarily the same person who watches History, which is more male skewing. I think it sort of worked. It sort of took something that sort of might not have done that well if it was just a Lifetime TV movie, and it immediately made the brand more interesting.
The networks are all doing more special big events. They're also all doing more limited series. In the coming years, we're going to see a lot. But at some point, there are going to be so many of these that are they going to be special anymore? Are they all going to be big events, or is there going to be viewer fatigue? One of the things that made Hatfields and McCoys such a success was it came out of left field, and people had kind of forgotten, oh yeah, viewers like these kind of things. But once we're bombarded with so many of them, and we're seeing marketing left and right.
I was going to say, I don't think it's a matter of the number of event series and miniseries. It's about how they're being marketed. You know, if you have a network every 2 months trumpeting something as huge, you need to tune in, and they're pumping all of their marketing resources, whether it be digital, print, on air and whatnot, you know, every month or two into some giant quote event series, then, you know, it's kind of the boy who cried wolf. It starts to lose its edge.
There will be blood. There will be failure. And I think you're right, Mike. I think that, as you know, talk about a typical network play. Yes, they are going to run this into the ground. You can see the train coming. You can see it, you know, doing what trains do when bad things happen. But I think at the same time, I think it's good that there's a sense of experimentation. I think it's important for networks, especially broadcast networks, but also cable, which they're facing plenty of competition on the cable side. They need to differentiate themselves. They need to stand out. They need to say, hey, we're here. And this is a great way to do it in only the way networks can. They have to find the right kinds of projects. And it has to be a mix. You know, some of what Fox is doing is a lot different than what NBC is doing, right? The Fox projects are basically series that are short orders. What NBC did was a one-time, two-time event. You know, there's a difference there.
Right. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Spinoff, the new monthly TV podcast from KCRW's The Business. I'm Michael Schneider, and I'm here with AJ Marischal of Variety and Joe Adalian of Vulture. So, next topic. So, those big, clunky on-screen bugs that pop up for a few seconds at the start of every TV show, often serving up this weird, hefty dose of alphabet soup, like TVMAL for South Park, or TV14DLSV for Bones. But if you're like most TV viewers, you probably pay no attention to TV's content rating system, or even really know what those letters stand for. It's been 15 years since the broadcasting cable networks launched TV's parental guidance rating system under heavy pressure from the government and special interest groups. But 15 years later, you don't hear much about them. You see them, but that's about it. AJ, do you ever pay attention to the content ratings?
Well, I actually came up with the content ratings. So I was one of the viewers where, you know, I went from, I guess, the TVG or whatever it was when I was a little kid watching Disney Channel. And I remember when I started watching things with TV 14 in the corner, I thought I was such a badass.
Yeah. Did your parents know? Were they saying, hey, that's TV 14?
No, my parents couldn't have given a part of my French. There you go, right
there.
That's
a whole different topic.
But I remember being like, what is the D in TV 14? Is that my mom's like, that's dialogue. I think it's dialogue, right? Like,
yeah,
adult-ish dialogue.
There's dialogue, there's language for L, there's S for sexual content, V for violence, and there's also something called FV, fantasy violence, for kids programming.
By the way, I think D stands for something different on HBO. But anyway, go on.
Well, the cultural critics, of course, have said through the years that the broadcast networks are now hiding behind these content ratings that shows like Criminal Minds, which is all about serial killers, or Revolution on NBC, where there is a high body count, are surprisingly low rated, that there are TV 14 for the most part. And the broadcast networks do pretty much avoid rating anything TVMA or for mature audiences. That's the domain of cable.
And let me say a couple of things. First of all, you know, there are groups like one that I shall not name that like to put out press releases bemoaning the networks for too much violence, too much this, whatever. I generally pay no attention to them. That said, I'll also say this, that there is too much violence on some shows on TV. Violence can easily be a crutch for producers who don't have interesting stories to tell.
Absolutely.
And simply want to shock you. Mm-hmm. And I think the biggest problem here is not that there is not enough censorship of network TV. There is too much censorship of network TV in that a broadcast network cannot use the S word. They cannot use other words that are commonplace on cable. So in order for these network shows to feel edgy and different, what's something they can do? Well, they can show someone being violent. They can show someone being blown away. They can show a grisly body, because in our society, that's okay.
Right, right. And even these cultural critics that we're not naming seem much more obsessed with language and sexual content than they are with violence.
Right. And if you took away those restrictions or at least allowed networks to do the same thing as not premium cable perhaps, but as basic cable, I think it would reduce some of the pressure and you'd have content that was much better.
I have two quick thoughts on that. First of all, at the Variety Emmy Showrunners Breakfast a few months ago, the showrunner from 30 Rock was saying, and 30 Rock was on NBC, obviously very strict when it comes to FCC guidelines and what they can put on air compared to something like HBO or Showtime. And he was saying, what I would give for one per season. What I would give. He's like, we would spend so much time working that one word into the show that on Veep is thrown around left and right. And it was true. I thought to myself, you have to be a lot more creative to propel a story if you don't have things like violence and graphic sex and profanity that can, as Joe was saying, become real crutches. And on Breaking Bad's final season, there was that that moment where Jesse Pinkman gets, Aaron Paul's character gets taken away by, I guess, those neo-Nazis. And there's an understanding that he's about to be tortured. And Vince Gilligan in his writer's room did not show the torture scene. You saw Jesse afterwards, just beaten to a pulp, but you did not see the actual torture scene. And I thought, what a wonderful creative decision, because then your mind is able to wander and think about that instead of having it just be so in your face and graphic. It was such a refreshing creative decision at a time when everybody is trying to push the gore to the next level.
And I just think the envelope needs to be, instead of pushing the envelope, the envelope needs to be equal and it needs to be open to everybody. And by that I mean to make sure that listeners understand, cable cannot be touched by the FCC. only the big four networks, big five networks, if you count the CW, can fall into the jurisdiction. So therefore, if you're on TBS at 10 o'clock, you can say whatever you want. If you're on NBC, you can't. And I think that's a big, giant distinction. And to me, I don't understand it. It's 2013. There is plenty of access to the media. This whole idea that there is any sort of thing as public airwaves is ridiculous. The networks don't do any kids
programming. Well, Joe, I mean, hold on a second. Okay. I mean, the idea of public airwaves, not ridiculous. And as a matter of fact, that is a huge distinction between broadcast and cable. The fact is, broadcast is free over the air, and there is a difference in sort of, you know, the ability of that those airwaves to hit any home versus people who spend money on cable.
Yeah, which is 90% of the country.
Money. But once you decide to put money down for cable, then yeah, you should be able to watch and see whatever you want because
so
you're
the,
paying
so
for
the poor,
it.
So the poor people of America who can't afford cable.
Well, don't
they
make this
should not be, well, that's basically
I
what
will
saying.
Take that conversation topic that, for a second and point out
a
like
a low, low blow.
You know,
but
broadcast
true.
Broadcast though is really feeling the heat from cable earlier this year in January. Fox's head, Kevin Reilly, was saying shows like Walking Dead are really pushing the envelope when it comes to edge and gore. And he, as somebody who's running a network, feels the need to answer that on broadcast.
Well,
then
and
you
he,
get the following.
Yes, and he did on
and
the following.
And NBC gets Hannibal. And Hannibal had really gory scenes, you know?
Right,
I mean,
because
people were being flayed open.
And that's let's get back to the topic we're at hand here. We're talking about violence on television. And one of the reasons the broadcast networks are doing more violence is because that's the only weapon in their quiver. They can't speak realistically. They can't show sex. They can't do any of those things that cable can. And so that leaves the worst possible one of all these options. What's going to harm a kid more? Seeing somebody kiss a little deeply, hearing them say a four-letter word, or seeing someone shoot their brains out? I would argue the latter is the worst possible outcome, yet that's the one in our society that the FCC does not care about. The other ones are prescribed. You cannot do that on television.
Well, and that's because they're getting letters from these content critic groups. And basically, these groups have their websites, and they have form letters. And all you do is hit a quick send button, and suddenly 500, 1,000, 5,000 letters are at the FCC's doorstep. And they have to investigate. And those seem to be the issues that these groups care about more. And suddenly, you know, the networks have one hand tied behind their back, as you said.
Here's the solution. Mike, you are right that the public airwaves do actually exist in the fact that they have a premium channel position. They go out anywhere. So let's make a deal with the broadcast networks.
Let's do it right now.
Okay, this is the deal right now we're making with the broadcast networks. You contribute a certain amount of financial dollars to PBS, to public broadcasting. And in exchange for that, you get to live by the same rules as basic cable. So let's make a deal. For that historic position of getting channel 2, 4, 5, 7, whatever, for that right to be on free over-the-air TV for as long as they are, which who knows how long that will be, you pay a certain amount of money. It goes to PBS to make more kids programming. You get to say whatever you want, and we can get the government, which conservatives say they want to get government out of our lives. Well, let's get the government out of my television. I don't need them there.
Oh, that's a complicated methodology. I think the simpler issue is for the FCC to really finally clarify just what are their content rules. It's been confusing to everyone for decades. And
what's simpler than no rules whatsoever, Mike? Why do we need the FCC regulating what's on television? Let them focus on other things. Why do they need to regulate what's on my TV? What's
Janet
the
Jackson's left breast, Joe. That's why.
Yes, I'm sure the country was scarred by that. I can't imagine anything in the last 10 years that's scarred us more than her nipple. Please.
Well, we're not going to solve this today, unfortunately, even if we are throwing proposals out to the broadcast network. So we're going to take a short break right now and come back with more of the spinoff from KCRW.
Hey, it's Kim Masters, host of The Business at KCRW. I want to ask you for your support. You are listening to this podcast for free, but guess what? It's not free to produce. So if you enjoy the show, please send us some support. Send us $10 by texting KCRW to the number 20222. One more time, text KCRW to the number 20222. Thanks.
We're back. It's The Spinoff, a monthly podcast from KCRW's The Business. I'm Michael Schneider, and I'm here with Joe Adalian and AJ Marischal. And starting this week, you'll be able to subscribe to The Spinoff through iTunes or wherever you download podcasts. It'll also still be found in the podcast queue of KCRW's The Business. Huzzah, everybody.
Huzzah.
Hello.
So now, 'tis the season for year-end recaps, and we're not above doing our own look back at the year that was. Memories. This was a big, game-changing year for television. As a matter of fact, guys, I ran into Warner Brothers TV president Peter Roth at a holiday party the other week, and after the requisite hug. He marveled at how much things had changed this year. And Netflix, of course, is at the center of all of that. As a matter of fact, I don't think any of us went 2 minutes in a conversation with a TV exec this year without Netflix somehow popping into the conversation. This, for better or for worse, this service and its original content, from House of Cards to Orange is the New Black to the revived Arrested Development. Now they're even getting into the kids' business with Turbo Fast, their first offering from DreamWorks Animation. It sort of threw everyone off their game this year. Network execs, cable execs, they're all just sort of amazed at this business and how it sort of took the world by storm. So guys, Netflix, I mean, that's got to be the story of the year, right?
Am I the only one that isn't that surprised by it? I mean, maybe it's because I was coming of age with Netflix in my life. So the idea that Netflix was then going to start putting out compelling original content, it didn't really like blow my mind against the wall, I think, that it did for other people. But to me, it seemed like the next evolution, the next step. But I think that in terms of the notoriety that it immediately built in the buzz around it and the stock value, I mean, that's definitely an eye-opening.
I think it was the way they did it. You're right, how the stock went through the roof, how they dumped every episode of a series all at once, and you know, how it just changed the way people binged watch this year.
But even more importantly, and more, what was amazing to me was how successful the shows were in terms of generating buzz. Now, what's important to remember, we have no idea if the only people who have actually watched it are on Twitter.
Exactly.
It could be 200 media reporters all talking to themselves about how great Netflix is.
We do know that Orange is the New Black has been the most watched of all the original series. We do know that. We don't know how many people have watched.
Right. But by the way, guys, this is what drove network execs nuts this year, is that all these shows were considered hits without a single ratings point.
FX's John Landgraf is just pulling his hair out.
Plenty of envy to go around in a business that may be known a little bit for envy. But Joe, you were saying.
But what was so great is that they have perhaps had the most auspicious debut of any quote-unquote network I can remember. I mean, AMC ultimately put on three good shows, but it took 3-4 years for it to all to coalesce into a critical mass. In 1 year, you can look at top 10 lists that are coming out this week, and there are some top 10 lists that have three network shows on it. Two of them made it onto AFI's year-end list. How good these shows are, how much they feel like regular TV, how much they got people to talk about them. In that sense, it doesn't matter, honestly, how many people watch, because people are talking about Netflix, and that's what Netflix wants. They want people to talk about them so that they make sure that they feel they have to subscribe to Netflix.
Yeah, and Joe, something else about those shows is that they were all picked up straight to series, no pilots.
Straight to series in some cases.
Or 2 seasons.
Right, 2 seasons in the case of House of Cards. And, you know, it's encouraging. You know, some of my peers, rightfully, I guess, sort of complain about not having ratings. And I'm a ratings junkie who would love to find out exactly how many millions of people watch every episode and when they watch and how they watch and how many watch only 2 episodes versus all 13. And that data is all great. But you know what? At the end of the day, Netflix is honestly freeing us from the tyranny of having to worry about that sort of nonsense.
See,
HBO does it to a degree.
That's what I think is the most interesting thing about Netflix this year. Not that they put out original content, but that they stimulated real discussion about two things: the validity of ratings when it comes to judging a show's success, and also how we are watching TV, how much we're consuming at a certain period of time. So it really was kind of like a zeitgeist moment in television to say, at a time when ratings are shifting so much with DVR and whatnot, to say, we're taking ratings out of the mix. How about that? And then at a time when people are binge watching shows online, to say, we're going to give you an entire season of a new TV show for you to binge watch. So it really hit like right at the perfect time and stimulated a broader discussion about these topics. So to me, it's not so much Netflix itself that's interesting, it's the discussion that it's
the overall impact. I mean, talk about binge watching for a second. I mean, Netflix really sort of brought that to the forefront, mm-hmm. of just, you know, changing viewer habits, and that's impacting everyone. And sort of, you know, do we stick with shows longer because we now know that people wait sometimes, they stack, and then they binge watch later. So maybe some of these shows that are low rated right now will suddenly get an audience down the road.
The Scandal effect and the Breaking Bad effect that was helped by Netflix.
And it's a way of just creating assets over the long term. The Wire on HBO was a show that nobody watched, even by HBO standards when it aired. It's now regarded as one of the best TV shows of all time. People talk about, I finally watched The Wire 5 years later. It becomes an
asset.
I'm
raising my hand in the studio.
It's the same thing. It's the same thing, by the way, sometimes you'll see in movies too, right? We saw that the 90s and the early aughts when movies would come out on DVD and people would find them in Blockbuster. Before there was Netflix, there was Blockbuster. People would find it, they'd rent it, they'd talk about it before there was Twitter, and they'd become sort of big. And then they'd do a sequel and they'd do even bigger. So the idea of a long tail, which is what Netflix is all about, is a great thing. And it's great for content. It's great for viewers. And it's great because it allows creators to be the ones who really determine what's going on, as opposed to some current executive who's just trying to make sure that the ratings among 18 to 34s are even from week to week.
You reminded me that Netflix did kill Blockbuster this year. So
RIP Hollywood Video. Excuse me. Everyone forgets about Hollywood Video, which I went to.
All right. Well, Joe, let's talk about your story of the year.
Well, for me, it's sort of off of I'll do a spinoff of yours. To me, this was the year in which TV came from everywhere, where the whole idea of only big networks providing some of the best TV sort of went away more than ever before. You had, in addition to the three great shows on Netflix, I'm sorry to Eli Roth, whose shows never gets mentioned, poor thing. But you also had Hulu coming up with The Wrong Mans, which is a great show I encourage everyone to check out. You have BBC America with Orphan Black, which was a compelling, wonderful show, along with Doctor Who. You have Sundance Channel, which did Rectify and Top of the Lake. TV came from anywhere this year, and it just showed that, you know, even though sometimes I think, gosh, do we need any more networks? Don't we have enough? You know what? When you have networks which sort of are allowed to be niche and allowed to just sort of follow the passion of their creators, it can result in a lot of great TV.
Well, it's great for viewers. There's more choice than ever, and we've got more networks coming online next year with WGN America doing their first scripted series, and E! And Bravo are getting into scripted in a big way, and you've got all these networks now doing scripted. So great for viewers. Now, of course, folks inside the industry are concerned that we are reaching a tipping point, that the ecosystem can't sustain all of these shows and all of these networks spending all that money on original scripted content. But for now, at least, we'll sort of watch the fireworks go and enjoy all these original shows.
Maybe what it will do is it will lead to an end of sort of the last remnants of least objectionable television, where we no longer have to have shows that are just okay, because no one cares about just okay when they have got plenty of shows they can watch whenever they want that are really, really good. I mean, who really wants to watch Sean Saves the World when you can watch anything else on TV? There's so many options. You don't need just this sort of, I guess sometimes people do like comfort food and just sort of zone out TV, and maybe that's great, and there'll be a couple networks that still do that. I don't think it'll be a tragedy if that goes away.
For me, somebody who is covering the TV industry and began covering the TV industry at a time when, you know, HBO, Showtime, AMC, FX, these are networks that are so prestigious right now. I was looking back at some of the primetime Emmy winners in writing from like the 90s and whatnot, and it's broadcast. And to me, that blew my mind. And I mean, obviously, it was eligibility issues. But the idea that that was where the amazing television is back in the 90s and even...
Well, yeah. Cable wasn't doing much.
Exactly. But like for me, like I can't imagine something on broadcast these days breaking out on the awards circuit in the drama space, because there's so much high caliber television right now on pay cable and cable. So like for me, I don't know a time when cable and pay cable weren't, you know, the top tier
well,
in television.
And that gets into a larger debate about, you know, broadcasters still having to be broad and not being able to reach niche audiences, which most of these critically acclaimed shows are. They're niche shows.
Can you do a critically acclaimed show that isn't niche?
Well, yeah.
Sure.
It's a good question. I mean, the Good Wife is on a broadcast network.
That's
it's
true. The
critically
Good Wife
acclaimed,
is
but it's their by far their most niche show.
It's,
so.
Yeah, and there's nothing niche about The Walking Dead or Breaking Bad. Those are broad appeal, massive hits that did very, very well with critics and did very, very well with viewers. I think it's a crutch. I mean, broad appeal, networks, just because networks aim for the fences doesn't mean they can't do really great television. Right. It's just an excuse. It's an indictment of their development process. And actually, after what AJ just said about Emmys and broadcast networks, I think we should make sure that they all, you know, the bar bars are going to be filled tonight with network executives drowning their sorrows because it's over.
All right. Well, on that note, AJ, what impacted you the most this year?
One of the things that really stood out to me this year was what I'm calling the Killing Effect. The Killing was a show on AMC, and it was canceled at the beginning of this year, only to then be revived thanks to a deal that AMC brokered between Netflix and Sony, the studio behind it. And then The Killing was canceled again this year, only to then be revived again, this time by Netflix, ordered, I believe, it's 6 episodes of the show to wrap it up. And what it has created, especially in the social media space with TV fans, is this sense of, if a show dies, did it really die? Could it get revived somewhere like Netflix when Don't Trust the Bee, which was considered to be a really smart comedy but did not perform
very
well. This
was an ABC sitcom.
Yeah, an ABC sitcom starring Kristen Ritter, was a smart comedy but wasn't really doing well in ratings, got canceled. Next thing you know, there are change.org petitions and Facebook groups dedicated to trying to revive this show on another network. One of my favorite examples of TV fans trying to urge a network executive to revive a show is The Borgias on Showtime. That show got canceled, and I don't know if you guys remember, but at the TCAs this summer,
I
was sitting outside having lunch with David Nevins during the Showtime lunch, and these fans of this show, I mean, there must have only been 20 of them, had a plane fly overhead with a banner flying behind it, directly addressing David Nevins, telling him to revive this show. They put a plane in the air about this.
People have always been passionate about good TV. Back in the 80s and 90s, there was a group called Viewers for Quality Television. And they lobbied, and I remember, they saved Cagney and Lacey, which was a show that got a reprieve from the X because of Viewers for Quality Television. And of course, you've had it, My So-Called Life. I worked on Operation Life Support, which was a viewer effort to try to get that show back. But what's great now, and what I think it says, AJ, about the fact that this is actually happening now, that the shows are being saved and are being revived, is that shows are now much more seen as living, breathing things with fan bases, as opposed to just widgets that are there to fill 9:30 Wednesday nights. They're living, breathing things that can actually move to different networks and different venues. You know, as I was saying earlier about all the different little venues that do great TV now, well, the same thing. Great TV can now go to all sorts of different networks. There's so many options. So as much as I sometimes get annoyed by the fact that there are 5,000 channels out there, most of which I will never watch and yet I continue to pay for, it's sort of good that there are now new ways for viewers to see what TV creators are trying to do. And it's a good time to be a TV creator.
Well, guys, I think we're going to have to leave it at that. Thank you, Joe.
De nada, Mike.
And thank you, AJ.
Thank you, and Happy New Year.
Happy holidays, guys. Hope Santa brings you all of your TV wishes. That was Joe Adalian, the West Coast editor for Vulture.com, and he tweets at TV Mojo. And AJ Marischal, who covers television for Variety, and you can follow her on Twitter at @Variety_AJM. And I'm Michael Schneider, the LA Bureau Chief for TV Guide Magazine, and my Twitter handle is @FranklinAvenue. And that's it for this edition of The Spinoff, the TV podcast from KCRW's The Business. This episode and all episodes of KCRW's The Business is produced by Darby Maloney. Melissa Morton is our technical director, and special thanks to the good people at KUNV in Las Vegas. You can find this and other episodes of The Business on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. You can also listen to us online at kcrw.com and on demand with the KCRW smartphone app. And that's it for our TV party. We'll see you next month.
Happy New Year.
Bye.
Happy New Year.